right. Today we're talking about the new Martin Scorsese movie. I've heard both Scorsese and Scorsese. Actually, I've even heard him say Scorsese, so I'm okay saying it. I could be wrong. How do you say Scorsese, Scorsese?
I say Scorsese.
Okay. I do too. And yeah. I think I've heard him say that, but I've definitely heard other people say Scorsese. So maybe he says Scorsese as well. So, sorry, Marty. But yeah, so that we just saw this in theaters. We are recording this well ahead of time. And what's funny too is we always talk about Oscars that our films we're discussing have received, but we are recording this in November of 2023, and this episode won't come out until after the Oscar, not just the nominations, until after the Oscar ceremony. So we'll talk about that here real quick and do some predictions, and we can see how right we are when this airs. So it is a 93/85 on Rotten Tomatoes. No Oscar nominations as of yet, but this is another kind of prestige Martin Scorsese film that is sure to garner several Academy Award nominations and probably wins. So what do you think? I guess let's start with wins, because I think that might be tougher. What do you think this could have a legit shot to? I know, of course, we haven't seen so many of the other contenders, obviously, but what do you think this could win at the Academy Award?
Okay, so...
And then we can add in nominations after that.
I think it could win some technical categories.
Yes.
So cinematography, probably.
Yeah, sound editing, those
it
kinds
could
of
win
things.
Sound, yeah. Yep. The, production design, like the costumes.
Yeah. Set design, set decoration. Yeah.
The sets and everything. I mean, it's all impeccable. Like, it's very immersive. Like, you really do feel like you are watching people in the 1920s. You know, it doesn't feel like, oh, I'm watching people pretend to be in the 1920s. It looks like it's the 1920s.
This is a great one for our whole project here. If we're doing American history in 100 movies, this one was just kind of perfect timing. And we're recording a bit out of order here to kind of make everything fit. So we will maybe repeat some things that you the listener, will have heard in the last couple of weeks that we haven't yet recorded. But other than that, it kind of fit perfectly in our recording schedule here with just having seen it in the theater. And yeah, it's kind of a must include. We always talk about how tough the Native American issues are to deal with. If anything, you could argue, if you look at our list, we've maybe, well, I hate to say overcorrected, but we have a lot of Native American representation, even if we feel like we struggle to fully explain the nuances of everything, because we always talk about how complicated it is. So I do like including them as much as we can. And what we lack a lot, and this I feel like has more to do, I'm going to blame society and Hollywood, but there's still definitely a lack of female protagonists in our list thus far. And I mean, there's just not a lot of movies about historical women in a lot of these instances that are easily found. Anyway, so we do get a Molly Kyle here as at least a woman of note to discuss a little bit and her plight throughout this film.
Yeah. In addition to the technical stuff, which I think it definitely has a good chance of, I will say that I think that, well, all the performances in this movie are really, really good, but the standout one to me was Lily Gladstone.
Yes.
I think she's got a good shot at getting an Oscar for that performance. It's really good.
If it wins one Oscar nomination, I think it's her. Yeah, I agree. Sorry, it was one acting. If it wins one acting Oscar, I think it's her.
Yeah.
I actually didn't really... This is the superstar problem. I thought Leo was one of the weaker performances. Not that he was bad, but like, it's because you know what Leonardo DiCaprio looks like, and I can handle the, like, the fake teeth or whatever. He actually was doing a great job. What annoyed me the whole time, the 3.5-hour movie, and I couldn't stop thinking about how Leo was forcefully holding his upper jaw holding his jaw up to look a little different. I'm like, I can see you tensing those muscles, Leo. That's not what this guy looks like. That's not what you're. It was just so artificial that it took me out of the movie, because he was just like distorting his face intentionally, like that little like grimace, like scowl or grimace, and how he's clenching his lower jaw. I'm like, I can see you tensing those muscles, dude. Like, stop it.
Well, Ernest Burkhart does have a little bit of an underbite. Like,
well, right, then add it with a prosthetic or something. Don't physically force it into the place that I can tell you're holding your mouth weird, because I know what you look like, because you're the most famous one of the most famous people on the planet. So it's honestly his fault. It's just someone being famous, but it just kind of took me out of it. And I would rather just, hey, stop doing that. Use the prosthetic teeth so you look a little goofier or whatever. But like outside of that, you're overdoing it, Leo. Stop.
Yeah.
And again, outside of that, the performance was good, but it annoyed me the whole time.
If I could be king of the world, I would give Brendan Fraser an Oscar for this movie for best supporting actor, just so he could get acting Oscars 2 years in a row. Just because I love Brendan Fraser so much. Brendan Fraser to the moon.
Nice. I was listening to another podcast, though. They talked about, like, Brendan Fraser seems to think he's in a completely different movie when he shows up. Like, tonally and stuff. But then I think the other person pointed out, like, yeah, but, like, he's the lawyer. He's supposed to be an ass. And so, anyway. Yeah, so the problem is with the high-end stuff, like, I don't think this wins Best Picture. And you could say Scorsese for director, but I haven't seen a lot of the other contenders. I can see this is Christopher Nolan's year with Oppenheimer. I think Oppenheimer wins Best Picture and wins Best Director. And I would say, actually, if anything, I'd say Director.
I'll be curious to see if Napoleon can gets any like Oscar traction.
I'm skeptical on that one. I think really Scott's kind of lost a step, and I think that one could get no nominations or get just cinematography or just set direction kind of stuff. But like, I mean, I just have some issues with the trailer already. I don't know. I think it's too hard to be. It's trying too hard to be serious without any kind of levity. It's trying to tell the whole Napoleon story with Joaquin Phoenix, who's already the age of old Napoleon at the end of his life. And so you're trying to show him as an up-and-coming guy, and he's like 30 years too old. I just think it looks horrible in the trailer as far as that goes. So yeah, it could totally work. I'm actually still kind of excited, and I hope it works. But it's one, if it's below the 70s on Rotten Tomatoes, I'm not even going to go see it. Like, so anyway, I'm cautiously optimistic, I guess, on Napoleon, but I'm not holding my breath on that one. Anyway, again, we still haven't seen so many of these other contenders. But yeah, I would say Nolan is ahead of Killers of the Flower Moon, even if something else swoops in and beats Oppenheimer, if that makes sense. Okay, so my next note here was that this film also seems to be, unfortunately, on the list of most accurate movies we've covered. Would you agree that overall this kind of just hits everything right on, with just kind of rounding some edges off here and there?
For the most part, the only thing is that, like, for a lot of the stuff that I was looking at, like, the only source is the book, Killers of the Flower Moon.
Gotcha.
Like, and I'm not saying that I am skeptical or I don't believe any of what's in that book. Like, I'm sure that the research in the book is solid. It's just that
it's hard to fact check.
It's the only source that I saw for a lot of this stuff.
Okay.
But that at the same time, it does kind of point to what a big theme in the movie of nobody talks about this stuff. And this is all kind of swept under the rug. And even though the perpetrators were convicted, they still kind of got off easy, to be honest. And yeah, it's a real blind spot historically.
Yes. Let me start with the rough timeline here, and then we'll talk about the Osage tribe, and then I'll kick it over to you to talk about the specific people involved here.
Okay.
So I do think the timeline is kind of round. Again, I kind of use the term rounding the edges off, and I think that's probably right. So the film, it opens like 1919 as Ernest is returning from World War One, where he says he was a cook. They mentioned the Spanish flu. And then at the other end of the film, 1925 was when they requested help from the FBI. And then the trial for the murders was in 1926. So roughly, the movie takes place between 1919 and 1926. But, and again, you kind of, this is more on your side, but I was just trying to establish the timeline. What I saw was Ernest and Molly were married in 1917, so not to cut too far ahead, was he even a World War One vet at all?
He was.
Okay.
He was just married before he went. And I'll talk about that when I go through his bio.
Okay. So little things like that. They kind of may make the marriage happen after, so they don't have to have him leave and come back, those kinds of things. The other thing on the timeline was the law that required the Osage to have like that guardian system in place, where basically the white people controlled the purse strings to the Osage money. That law wasn't passed until 1921. So if we're starting this film in 1919 and it seems like that system is already in place, that may not be exactly accurate. So little things like that where there's kind of like streamlining some things. Like, so instead of dealing with introducing a factor midway, we'll just say that factor has already been in place for simplicity's sake, which that, as faults go, that's honestly probably pretty minor. So the Osage tribe here in Oklahoma is who we are focusing on. And that tribe goes back actually to about 700 BCE in the area where the Ohio and Mississippi rivers meet. So it's kind of where modern Missouri, Illinois, and Kentucky all converge. Over the centuries, they slowly migrated west, keeping in mind, this is, as always with our Native American stuff, vastly oversimplified, and things just kind of, yeah, it takes a lot of time, and it's not as simple as one-to-one, one exact tribe is exactly right here. Like, doesn't really work that way, but roughly speaking, by the time that the Indian Removal Act of 1830 was passed, they actually were largely in Kansas, but they didn't move immediately south to Oklahoma with the Indian Removal Act, but it kind of started that slow process. Mostly, actually, is after the Civil War is when they moved from Kansas into Oklahoma. And there's actually, and actually, it was even one of the teams there's an Osage City, Kansas, and like we competed against them in state cross country, and their mascot's the Indians. And although also it looked like, again, I'm sure it's more complicated than this, but it looked like where they were in Kansas isn't quite where Osage City, Kansas is. So I'm not sure what's going on there. But when they moved to Oklahoma, they were relatively unique in the fact that they could actually purchase their reservation in Oklahoma. So a lot of people were just kind of like allocated, like, here's the government land you can stay on. The Osage actually bought their land from the government in 1872 when they moved down to Oklahoma. So so that land is basically what is Osage County, Oklahoma today. Four communities were set up, one of which was Fairfax, which is where the film today is set. And they kind of struggled at first. There were harsh winters. Government aid was, you know, slow in getting there. Poverty was an issue. Even before they had come down from Kansas, there was some disease outbreaks. So, you know, I mean, it's the late 19th century. Life was pretty tough. But yes, as we see at the beginning of the film, in the mid-1890s, oil was discovered on Osage land, which, again, land they owned, not government land. So that becomes hugely significant. So yeah, we kind of see this oil strike and the natives, the Osage, dancing in the oil. And that's, I mean, obviously probably an oversimplification, but yes, they did strike oil. And so the oil interests, the people actually, you know, are the professionals in getting oil out of the ground, move in, and the government says, hey, okay, we'll give you these leases on Osage land, but you gotta, of course, I still think they get screwed from the beginning, if I got this right, but you gotta give 10% of all sales back to the Osage. So you can get the lease, but 10% has to go back to the Osage. And so that's when head rights come in. So this film just constantly talks about head rights, which is a film I wasn't super familiar with. I mean, I'd probably heard it before, but I really didn't know what it is. Had you heard the term head rights before this film? Regards to like lands and oil and stuff?
No, I had never heard the term head rights, but the movie does a good job of, they never have someone come out and explain, oh, head rights are when blah, blah, blah. Right. Like, which I really appreciated, but it also did a good job of just contextually explaining what head rights were. Because when I first heard that, I was like, wait, what is that? Is that like an inheritance or is that what is that? But then as the movie went on, I was like, oh, okay, it's like a dividend that they get from oil money, and everyone, all the Osage have it. So if you're Osage at the time, you know, then you have it, then, you know, you can inherit it down through your family. But yeah, no, I had never heard that term before I saw this movie.
Okay, yeah. So the term, again, roughly speaking, everything, I feel like we're always kind of just rounding, and especially this stuff, it's like, it seems to be this. So the term seems to go like to colonial Virginia, and it was kind of a way to entice colonists to come over if you basically would promise them a certain amount of land per head. So, hey, if you're paying for yourself to come over, you get a little bit of land. Oh, but if you pay for 13 people to come over, you get 13 people's worth of head rights. And so you would basically get more land to your claim. So the more people you could afford to bring over, the more land you would get allocated to you per head right kind of thing. So it kind of goes back to that. And they're just kind of used, you know, in real estate in the U.S. kind of after that. So specifically, there's even a specific number that was cited. So they divided up the land and for head right purposes, I don't think it was necessarily the land you lived on or whatever, but for rights purposes, they divided up the land among 2,229 people, and each of those was a head right. So essentially, you were getting, if you're one of those, it basically was just the registered tribe members at the time or whatever. So you were essentially getting one 2,229th of that 10% that the oil companies were required to kick back.
Right.
And then there was also a communal fund elsewhere, but the head rights were more valuable. So like everyone was getting a cut of like the overall thing that was like underneath because they couldn't say where that was coming from or whatever. But and then the head rights were more important. And this was all getting finalized as Oklahoma was becoming a state in 1907. And the film does state correctly, they were briefly per capita the richest people in the world because basically the average, this made the average income in these Osage communities the equivalent to about $600,000 a year, which doesn't sound like the richest people in the world, but that's again per capita. If the average income of your right. county is $600,000 per person, that's still today going to be one of the richest places on earth. Yeah. So that's kind of what they had going on.
That's something that I really wish that the movie would have focused on more or fleshed out a little bit more, like
how rich they were.
Not how rich they were, but like the fact that you have the they're basically. They're native, so they're like second-class citizens anywhere else. But then in their own community, they're super rich, and then they have all these white Americans come in who are then second-class citizens in the Osage part. Like, I wish that they would have focused on that dynamic a little bit more, you know. And with Leo's character, too, you know, what is it like for him to basically to go into that, especially because he is coming from his uncle's family who's already rich, and they're like rich white people, but then he is then relegated to this taxi driver job. I don't know. It's that's like my biggest issue with this movie is it's almost like a documentary more than it is a narrative, like what I would expect from a Marty Scorsese movie. Like, it's just kind of, this is stuff that happened and it happened in this order, but we're not really going to go any farther than, you know, deeper than the surface as far as like what it means to these people, how these people are feeling about it. I don't know.
So what's interesting, and so listening, again, I think it was The Big Picture. I was listening to them break it down and they were talking about the book. If I understood correctly, they said the book is actually like shifting narratives. Like, here's the whole story from this person's point of view, and now we're going to cut over and here's the story from this person's point of view. And I always think that would have been way more interesting and compelling, and when it would have been able to tackle what you're talking about. And it seems weird that they so initially they said Leo was supposed to play the FBI agent, and significant point of view of this whole thing was coming into town and learning the whole events through the FBI agent's point of view with him as the lead character, and then they kind of shifted away from that.
I had heard that too, and I actually like that they didn't do that.
Okay.
Because I think that would have been too much. That would have been too much like a, oh, this is just another
white savior film almost.
Yeah. And not, I don't necessarily have an issue with that. It's just, it's a lot more interesting to have it be, have the story basically be from the point of view of a guy who is not the hero. Like, Leo's not playing like, oh, yeah, I'm the suit. Yeah. I'm coming in. I'm investigating. I'm saving everyone. You know, I'm figuring it out. No, the point of view character is like he's an absolute piece of shit. Like, he's a horrible dude. He's not the hero. But he is the point of view character, which I actually like.
That's a good point.
That aspect of it,
right?
But I would have liked to have gone a little deeper into the characters instead of just here's all the events that happened, which I know is hard to do because, as we've discussed, this movie is 3.5 hours long, and that's how long it takes to get through all the events that they want to talk about in the movie. So, I don't know, maybe make it more of a, I don't know, I don't know how you would, I don't even know how you would do that. And, you know, maybe this is, Marty Scorsese he's a better filmmaker than I am, so maybe he did do it the right way, and I just don't know what I'm talking about. But
well, but to your point, I was not emotionally invested in the film. So even though like these horrible things are happening,
right,
I'm watching them with like a straight face. Like, there's no emotional ties to any of these people.
Right. The only person that I felt any kind of emotional connection to was Molly.
Right.
And only barely, and only really towards the end.
Right. And she does give a great performance, but there's still, yeah, it's, there wasn't that emotion to it because you're not necessarily invested in them beyond the superficial level. You almost should have shifted, and because he's the main character, not her. And even though we see her without him on screen, it always seems like this is let's show you the side character, the woman here, before we cut back to Leo's character, who's actually the protagonist, even though he's also kind of the antagonist. So it's like, from the story standpoint, she is the protagonist, but they're not treating her like it. They're treating Leo like it. So yeah, it's a subtle shift.
Right, it's weird.
But we meet her from his point of view. They should have had us meet him from her point of view.
Yeah.
Because we're following him, picking up, he's meeting his uncle, and he's getting the job, and he's running the cab. And then, here's this fare I can pick up, and I think she's kind of cute, and I know she's rich. Versus show the rich lady who then meets the young guy who she doesn't know if she can trust or not. Like, this is a subtle perspective switch that she could have.
And I think that's a big reason why the surprise Marty Scorsese cameo at the end fell a little bit flat for me. Because he's like, okay, so then we get, basically the idea is, for people who haven't seen it, the scene is it's a radio show.
Right, this is the denouement to kind of wrap up the end. Instead of title cards at the end, they kind of do a little radio play from like the 50s or whatever.
Which I thought, that's kind of cool, that's kind of creative. But then right at the end of that, Marty Scorsese comes out and reads like basically the last paragraph of it, where he talks about, how Molly basically died in obscurity, and in her obituary, the murders were never mentioned. And it's like, I could tell that he wanted that to be a really emotional gut punch, like an emotionally impactful moment. But I'm like, that is not earned. Like, that, the movie didn't earn that. The movie didn't establish that emotional connection with her enough to where that actually mattered to me at the end.
And we talked about this a little bit off air, but it's like, that totally worked for me. Scorsese has made cameos in tons of his movies, not necessarily all, but like, he's long made cameos in his movies. And so like, it was a little jarring at first and a little bit of a fourth wall break, but it was exactly that fourth wall break that actually brought me a little bit of emotional connection and reminded me, oh crap, this isn't just a movie, this really happened. And they're intentionally having Martin Scorsese come out and tell you, yeah, this actually happened. This is what this actual lady went through. And let me now remind you, by reading her obituary, how significant this was and what a travesty it was that it's not still talked about. So I saw it was a fourth wall break, but I didn't find it distracting. I actually found it more emotionally impactful because they chose to have Scorsese come on to do it.
Huh. Okay.
Even if it was a little jarring. But yeah, but I mean, I'm not saying I completely get where you're coming from with it, but for me it worked. Anyway. Yes, so the Osage were rich. And because of that, and what we were talking about with the film, that just kind of opens up everything to corruption. I wrote my notes, being because the powers that be, quote, white people, can't help themselves. Congress passes a law in 1921 that says the Osage had to have a guardian until they could prove competency. So basically, you're crazy until the government says you're not. Like, how is that not just rife for corruption, which is, of course, exactly what happened?
Right.
So you had we do see the kind of the people in the community, they're kind of holding the purse strings for the Osage. They basically, yes, it's your money, but you have to ask the white people for it.
And I didn't see this. This is something else that I didn't see this specifically anywhere else other than the movie, which is based on the book. So like, I wouldn't be surprised if this was true, but it was wild to me that Molly has to go to a guy to ask for money, her own money. She has to go and ask this guy, this white banker guy, for money. And that guy is the leader of the KKK in Osage.
Right. I couldn't find that connection specifically.
Right.
But it's kind of the spirit of it. Yeah.
That was insane.
Right. Yeah, and she even kind of says incompetent. And it's like, what is she talking about? Because she doesn't seem like it's like, oh, no, because like basically the government said you all are incompetent until someone comes in and says otherwise. And so we have to protect you from yourselves, which is the whole, we always talk about, like, that's like the British and India stuff, where it's just this white supremacy kind of thing. We care for them, so we got to protect them from themselves because they're just savages, and we'll come in and protect them. And it's like, no, you're coming to exploit them, you... So yes, and so and that's just the banking side of it and the money side of it. Then you also have white men were marrying into the Osage community. They kind of make a point early in the film to kind of even before Leo and Lily's character, I guess I should say Ernest and Molly get together. We see just like walking the streets. It's all these white men with all these Osage wives, and it's all just to get their money. And there were several deaths, likely murders, that went uninvestigated. And basically, just despite all their money, the Osage just still had too little power. The white man is still in charge, even if they're not in charge. And it was the murders of Molly's family that finally gets the FBI to come down and investigate. And of course, it wasn't even the FBI yet, which you'll talk about later. In 1925, Congress did step in again. Film doesn't deal with this at all, but they actually passed another law that said to inherit the head rights, you had to be at least half Osage, which would eliminate basically the reason like Ernest and his uncle are doing all of these murders is so that the head rights come to them ultimately. This law basically said like, no, unless you're at least half Osage, you're not getting these head rights. So yeah, your kids maybe can get them, but you're not getting them if you're just this white guy who's married in. And if I understood correctly, those head rights are still passed on today. I couldn't find anywhere that said what the revenues currently are, but I do know a lot of that land is still active throughout Oklahoma. Because actually, so I have family from Oklahoma, and my dad actually, so we're not Osage at all, or no Native American connection, but just from like Oklahoma land rights, my dad still gets a check every year from like Oklahoma mineral rights for land that has, like the land isn't in the family anymore. But the mineral rights still are, and so my dad gets a check every year. I mean, it's tiny. It's like $500 a year or whatever, but it's not nothing. But it is kind of a similar system to where it's like these rights that were passed down for minerals being mined on Oklahoma land. So even after the land is sold, you still keep mineral rights.
Huh. That's interesting.
And today there are just over 13,000 official Osage tribe members, with about half of those living in Oklahoma. They own several casinos today, and that's just kind of where things stand today. So yeah, give us a little more specifics on Ernest and his uncle, William Hale, and maybe even then how the FBI starts to tie into all of this and get started.
All right, so I guess I'll start with William Hale.
Played by Robert De Niro in the film.
That's Robert De Niro's character in the movie. He was born on December 24th, 1874, in Texas. He grew up working as a ranch hand and a cowboy in West Texas and on the Kiowa Comanche Reservation. And then in 1905 is when he moved to Oklahoma. He moved to Fairfax and then bought his ranch in 1907. He was uneducated, but he was very good at fraud. Well, not even really good at it. He just got away with it really easily. Fraud, insurance fraud, and just straight up taking advantage of Osage people who a lot of times had no other option than to deal with him. And then through the connections that he would make with that, he, you know, owned a majority stake in the Fairfax Bank. He was a reserve deputy sheriff. Actually, this is something that will come up later on in the investigation, but when the BOI showed up to do their investigation, they quickly learned that they couldn't trust pretty much any local law enforcement because of their connections to Hale. And basically, Hale had compromised the chiefs of police in Fairfax and Ponca City, the Osage County prosecutor, and the local Bureau of Indian Affairs agent. All of those people were under Hale's thumb.
In his pocket, yeah.
And in his pocket. With that, I will... So he is Ernest Burkhart's uncle, and I'll talk about Burkhart's early life real quick. So Ernest Burkhart, he was born in 1892 on September 11th in Greenville, Texas. The movie, like you mentioned before, does mess with his early timeline a little bit. So he actually moved to Fairfax to live with his uncle on the ranch in 1912.
Mm.
It wasn't after the war like we see in the movie. So he had been there for a while. He also married Molly Kyle before he went to war, not after. So that is also a bit of a timeline difference. He married Molly Kyle in 1917. So at that time, obviously, World War I was ongoing, and the United States had joined the war. So he had to register for the draft, which he did on June 5th of 1917. He did serve as a cook with the 56th Infantry. That is accurate. His service began in June of 1918, He did go to France for an unknown duration and then comes back to the U.S. in June of 1919. So he's there for basically just a few months right at the end of the war. And then he's discharged in July of 1919. So that brings us to the time period of the murders. So there were a bunch of murders of Osage that happened in the early 1920s. Not all of them were connected to Hale, but a lot of them were. So the main ones, and some of these are in the movie, some of them are not, but the main ones, the first one is Anna Brown. So that's Molly's sister. She was murdered on May 27th, 1921. And like we see in the film, she's murdered by Kelsey Morrison for $1,000 and then a clearing of a $600 debt by Hale. So Hale basically paid him to murder Anna Brown. And they made sure to, because she had been married before, and they made sure to wait until after she was murdered to murder her.
After she was divorced. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So that way the head rights would go to her mother and not to her spouse.
Yeah, you had said they waited until after she was murdered to murder her.
Oh, after she was divorced. Sorry, after she was divorced to murder her. They waited until after she was divorced. That way, her husband didn't get the head rights. Her mom did, Lizzie Q. So then in June of 1921, the next month, a cousin of Molly's named Charlie Whitehorn was shot and killed. In July of 1921, so yet another month after that, Lizzie Q, who is Molly's mother, dies suspiciously in Ernest Burkhart's home.
And she was old enough, like the film kind of says, like, well, did she just die or was it kind of, she kind of pushed over the edge?
Yeah, in real life, though, I think it was more suspicious than what they showed in the movie. Because in the movie, she's kind of like sickly and old. In real life, she was basically like, I mean, got sick, but it was like a quick onset sickness and was like pretty obviously a poisoning.
Mm.
So she dies in July. Later in 1921, a Osage man, not related to Molly, but another Osage man named Joe Greyhorse, air quotes, mysteriously dies after making a land deal with Hale.
And that was not in the film then, right?
No. I don't think that one was.
Huh.
But even though that murder wasn't in the film, we do see stuff like that in the film, like where after the BOI shows up and they're out at Hale's farm and everything's on fire and they're there with the insurance guy who's helping them with the investigation. She's like, I just sold him like last week or last month or whatever, like a massive fire insurance policy. And wouldn't you know, his whole ranch catches on fire.
Right.
Which actually, that insurance stuff is part of what gets Hale in trouble. So in March 26th of 1922, an Osage woman named Anna Sanford dies after marrying a man named Tom McCoy. So Tom McCoy marries this woman. She dies. Then Tom marries William Hale's niece.
Huh.
So we have and he inherited her head rights.
Right.
So now we have yet another connection where more head rights are flowing, being funneled towards Hale.
So as much murder and corruption as Hale's juggling in the film, they cut most of it out?
They cut a lot of it out, yes. Yeah, they didn't even include all of it.
Wow. It would have become unbelievable. It would have been like, okay, we get it. And you're like, right. They had to make it less bad so you'd actually believe it.
Right, because otherwise the movie would have been 6 hours long, and it's like, oh my gosh, how many times are we just going to have to watch these people just get married, get murdered, get married, get murdered?
Wow.
Like, that's what was happening. Wow. That's what was happening. Later in 1922, Molly's sister Minnie is killed. Again, Molly is the one who inherits her head rights.
Is that the explosion one?
No. this is a different sister.
Is she in the film? Is this another one they left out?
I remember the name Minnie, but I don't remember her.
What's the sister that gets blown up in the film?
Rita.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Rita and Bill, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Huh.
So like I said, I thought that they said Minnie, but I don't remember. Oh, no! Minnie, So Bill Smith, right, who was blown up with Rita,
his first wife. He's married to
that's
two different sisters. That's right.
Yes.
He was married to Minnie first, then to Rita. That's right. Because he even says that Rita was such a comfort when Minnie died, and yeah.
Right, yeah.
It's almost like he's running his own side hustle, which is kind of why they take him out, but it's like he's also just after head rights, it seems.
Yes, yeah. because Bill Smith, yeah, he was married to Minnie. Minnie dies, so he inherits her head rights.
He's doing it more. He's doing it more honest. In a way, of course, in a way, basically, he gets killed because he's trying to undermine Bill's plans. Yeah,
right.
In the film, anyway.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Hale says there's only enough room in this town for one person doing head right murder scams. So
exactly. Well, Bill's not implicated in any murders, though, is he? He's just doing the marrying thing.
Yeah, but Minnie did die.
Oh, and Hale's not responsible for that one, huh? Or was he? Or we don't know. This is all that we don't know.
I didn't actually see one way or the other, but okay. Either way, Bill
benefited from it.
Bill marries Minnie. Minnie dies, so Bill gets her head rights. Gotcha. Then he goes and marries Rita, who's another sister who also has head rights. Right. So it's like
it's suspect, even if he didn't kill Minnie. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Then in January of 1923. A cousin of Molly's named Henry Roan is found shot in the head in his car. That's the guy who we see in the movie where
he's depressed.
He's depressed. Ernest has, you know, tells the guy, hey, you need to kill him, shoot him right in the forehead so it makes him look like a suicide, but he doesn't. He shoots him in the back of the head.
And takes the gun. It's like, you can't be a suicide if you take the gun with you.
Right. Yeah. Basically just absolutely fumbles it. But Hale held a $25,000 life insurance policy on Henry Roan.
Which they do show that in the film, right.
Right. So even though he wouldn't have stand to inherit that guy's head rights if he had any.
He was trying to collect life insurance. Yeah.
He was trying to collect the life insurance. Then in early 1923, an Osage man named George Bigheart was taken to a hospital in Oklahoma City by Ernest Burkhart and William Hale after drinking poisoned whiskey. While in the hospital, George asks to talk to his attorney, and wouldn't you know it, both George and the attorney end up dead.
What?
So George is up dying of the poisoning, and then the attorney is found murdered outside of town later on.
Wow.
And I'm not laughing because it's funny. I'm laughing at how absurd and
the audacity
and brazen this stuff is. Like,
it's so clear. It's right. They talk about the one of the podcasts I was listening to talking about how, like, this is just stupid people getting away with blazing murder because they thought they could get away with it.
Yes.
And they did until they didn't.
Right. Yeah.
They basically were just so overzealous with their murderers that, like, at some point someone was going to step in and stop them. And they just thought they were invincible.
Right. But it took how many years
right.
and dozens of bodies
right.
and getting the federal government involved because all the local police was just looking the other way.
Right.
If they cared at all in the first place.
Right. Wow.
So, yeah. And then in March of 1923, that's the explosion.
Okay. That kills Bill and Rita.
Bill and Rita Smith and their housekeeper, Nettie Brookshire, are killed when their house is bombed. And then at that point, Molly Burkhart had inherited
basically all her family's, right?
All of her family's head rights. So Lizzie, Minnie, Anna, Rita, and Molly, so five head rights are all held by her, and she is at that time being poisoned by Ernest.
And I mentioned one head right was the equivalent to about $600,000 a year, and she's got five times that, which is about $3 million a year.
Right.
And I could be off on that, but yeah, roughly speaking there. And then I also I think I saw that in the film they bring in the guy who knows how to use all the TNT dynamite stuff to blow up the house. And basically he makes the bomb too big and like does just take out that house. But like Lacey leaves nothing left, showers all the windows. I thought I'd read online that was kind of accurate, that basically they overdid it with the explosive. It was like bigger than necessary, kind of like we see in the film, but not that that's a
probably, but that just, again, it just speaks to the fact that these guys are all just idiots. They're all morons. They're all, none of them know what they're doing.
Right.
And that, like, when they have actual investigators come in, they're like, oh, this is very clearly, you know, these guys. Like, it's obvious.
True. It's like the easiest investigation ever. Right.
Right. It's not like a decades-long investigation like it's, you know, Brad Pitt and Morgan Freeman and Seven. Like, no, these guys are just morons. They're very clearly guilty.
And like, he comes in and when the FBI agent comes in, and goes to Ernest's house and is like, well, I'm here about the murders see about the murders. And Ernest is like, see what about them?
Yeah.
And the agent's like, who's doing them? Like, and that's in the trailer. And it's like, it's not even played for laughs, but like it does kind of speak to is like Ernest is just an idiot. Like,
yes,
the moment that guy knocked on your door, you're toast. Like,
yeah,
the moment someone who's not corrupt is coming in and looking at this for more than 2 seconds,
you're screwed.
And the locals couldn't do it because they had no power and would just get killed themselves. So the moment an outside party came in, it's like, oh, like you said, yeah, this is very, very obvious. This guy's been murdering all these guys.
Right. Well, and they almost don't take into account at all the number of people that they've paid to do their dirty work. And it's like, those people are going to flip on you in 2 seconds.
Right.
They have no reason not to.
It's a house of cards. Yeah. Hopefully another modern house of cards has similarly fallen by the time this episode airs.
I don't know.
Yeah, fair enough.
I don't know.
We'll move on.
I wouldn't hold your breath on that one, Rich.
That's a good point. All right, moving on.
All right, moving on. So like I said, Molly's being poisoned by Ernest. She ended up moving to Pawhuska, which is another town in that area, after Rita was killed. And wouldn't you know it, once she leaves Ernest and he's not the one giving her insulin injections anymore, oh, she just gets better. And so she also immediately figures out, oh, that's what was happening the whole time.
Oh, so it's not like the film then.
What do you mean?
The film makes it like he gets arrested and then she's rescued because he's arrested. You're saying like she gets better when she just moves away after her sister dies?
So that's what I saw was okay. That she moved away.
I think it's different than the film. That yeah.
I guess that what we see in the film could be described as that because it would time out the same way. Like she does move away after, and it is after the explosion. So I guess that
well, no, in the film she's rescued. Like the government the FBI pulls her out of.
Oh right, so that's something that might be in the book. Okay. That maybe has gone into more detail in the book. I just, from what I was reading, that she moved to Pawhuska. So, like I said, I don't know if that...
How that timed out with FBI intervention. Okay, okay.
Right. I don't know if that is in the book or if that's something that they put in the movie. Because the way that it is in the movie, too, it's specifically the undercover Native American guy. Because right. There's the one FBI agent that's... He's a native guy who shows up, he's undercover, and he's the one who rescues her. And that is kind of like a poignant moment in the film because it's like, yes, it's the government, but also it's a fellow native. Who,
right.
He's the one who shows enough concern to go in and see if she's okay. And then he finds her about to die from the poisoning. So, yeah, I'm not sure if that is what's in the book or if that's historically accurate. But either way, she leaves Fairfax. And once she is separated from Ernest, she gets better.
Right.
Once she receives actual medical attention.
Right.
So she ends up leaving Ernest because she realizes, oh, he was trying to murder me the whole time. And her children are the ones who inherit her head rights later on. So this kind of brings us to the investigation by the BOI.
What does that stand for? Remind me what that stands for.
So BOI is Bureau of Investigation. So FBI is the Federal Bureau of Investigation. That organization that today is the FBI has had a few different names, one of which is BOI, which is the Bureau of Investigation. Okay. That's what it was called when it was first founded. I think later on, between being BOI and the FBI, it was called the DOI. It was like the Division of Investigation.
Okay.
But BOI, FBI, I'll probably use them interchangeably, but it's just
okay.
The federal bureau that is in charge of investigating crimes. So the BOI itself was actually established after the 1901 assassination of President McKinley. So after that assassination, Teddy Roosevelt was really worried about anarchists in the United States, basically non-state actors who would try and disrupt or interfere with government operations. So he wanted to have more power and more tools with which to combat that threat. So he instructed the Attorney General at the time, a guy named Charles Bonaparte, to construct a new investigative service under the Attorney General. So they would report only to the Attorney General and the Department of Justice. I think initially they were going to take guys from the Treasury under the Secret Service to man that bureau, but Congress decided against that. Even though when the BOI was later established, a lot of the guys that made up that first kind of cohort of FBI agents had prior Secret Service experience.
And today, the Secret Service is under the Treasury, but what's the FBI under today? Or is it autonomous?
I think the Secret Service actually falls under the Department of Homeland Security now.
Oh, like, is that a recent switch?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because they did for a long time fall under the Department of the Treasury, and today their investigations are mostly focused on, like, money, counterfeit money, financial crimes, but they no longer fall under the Department of the Treasury. They fall under the Department of Homeland Security, which is kind of a newer
department.
A newer department that was formed after 9/11.
But that's Secret Service or FBI?
That's Secret Service. The FBI is the Department of Justice.
Oh, so it is under the AG or AG then. Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yep. I was thinking they were almost separate just in case you wanted that extra level of separation. But they're okay.
No, there's a director of the FBI, but ultimately they fall under the Attorney General.
Does the director of the FBI report to the Attorney General? Or not necessarily?
Yes.
Okay.
I think, let me look that up.
That's true. That is, yeah, it's not something everybody knows off the top of their head.
So, yeah, the FBI, it falls under the Department of Justice, and because the Department of Justice is headed by the Attorney General, the director does report to the Attorney General.
Okay.
Okay, so they were officially established on July 26th in 1908, and their main job, especially the beginning, is to be the investigative body for federal crimes. We'll talk more about FBI activities because it's going to show up a lot in the U.S. history timeline. So I'm not going to today they do this. And, you know, throughout their history, they've done this, because it's a really long list and it's going to come up again.
And we will have talked about it already in Reds and stuff.
Yeah. One thing that I will mention, though, is that in the film, they talk about, I think it's in that conversation that Jesse Plemons is the actor, but what's the,
oh, right,
the agent?
Tom White.
So Tom White and Ernest Burkhart are talking, and he said, "Oh, well, who sent you, the president?" And he said, "No, J. Edgar Hoover." And he's like, "Oh, I've never heard of him."
Oh, like, yep.
You know, the fact that this is the first J. Edgar Hoover reference, which is also another name that we're going to be hearing a lot, because he was the director of the FBI for 48 years.
Oh, that's insane. Yeah.
Yeah. So from 1924 to 1972, J. Edgar Hoover was the director of the FBI.
But we probably won't do the Hoover movie because, like, it got pretty bad reviews.
Yeah, but, well, I have a solution for that, though. Not to watch that movie. We don't need to watch that movie, but I'll bring it up after we're done recording, because I actually added, I put another movie on the list. I didn't, like, change any of the order or anything, but I wanted to talk to you about it.
Okay.
So anyway, and that would have been accurate, that Ernest Burkhart, despite being an idiot, had he lived at any other time, probably would have heard the name J. Edgar Hoover, because he became pretty famous later on. But he had just been appointed as the director of the FBI in 1924.
Oh, okay.
He was, like, brand new director of the FBI. So the BOI ends up showing up to investigate all these murders that are going on in the Osage Nation. The first person that they talk to is a guy named Dick Gregg. He's a local gangster, and he's their first witness. He told the BOI that William Hale, tried to get him to kill Rita and Bill Smith, but he refused, not because he doesn't want to murder anybody, but just because he didn't want to murder a woman. He was fine with killing just Bill, but he didn't want to murder a woman, so he said no. But he recommended that they talk to Al Spencer, Henry Grammer, and Curly Johnson. And this is a little bit of a side note, but Henry Grammer in the movie is played by country music star Sturgill Simpson. And I would highly recommend anybody into country music, go listen to Sturgill Simpson. His stuff's really good. But he's the rodeo guy, the one that goes to Dallas with Hale to give him an alibi for the bombing.
Okay.
Yeah, who later dies in the car crash.
Yeah.
That was, like, pretty obviously due to sabotage by Hale.
I was trying to think where I know the name, but I'm guessing it's from Sam Kasner.
Oh, is he a Sturgill Simpson fan?
I'm pretty sure, yeah.
I mean, probably. Sturgill Simpson's really good. Anyway, so this guy, Dick Gregg, says, go talk to Al Spencer, go talk to Henry Grammer, go talk to Curly Johnson. The BOI goes and tries to talk to all those guys. They're all dead. All three of them.
Wow.
And not in like, oh, he had a heart attack, or, you know, it was an accident. Like, Grammer, he died in that auto accident that was, it was probably sabotage. I didn't see how Al Spencer died. And then Curly Johnson was poisoned. So they're all three murdered.
Oh, is that the one in the film where he basically tells the shop owner, hey, I think someone's going to rob your place at 11:30 tonight. And then he tells the other guy, hey, go rob this place at 11:30 tonight.
That's Asa Kirby. That's the next guy I'm going to get into. So then another witness, a different witness, tells the BOI, hey, look into this guy, Asa Kirby. He's in tight with Hale. I think he might have had something to do with Bill and Rita getting killed. So they want to go talk to him, but then he ends up getting killed in a failed jewelry heist like we see in the movie.
Okay.
And they figure out that basically Hale had tipped him off to go rob this guy's store and then tipped the store owner off that, hey, these guys are going to come rob your store to get them to get in a shootout and hopefully, which it ended up happening, killing Asa Kirby. Then a guy named Bert Lawson told the BOI that Hale and Burkhart had told him to place a bomb in the Smith home. So now we get an actual witness who is directly implicated in the murder, who then directly ties Hale and Burkhart to the murder.
Right.
And then also at this same time, Hale is doing no favors for himself because he, while there's an FBI investigation going on for all these murders, is like causing a fuss at the insurance agency because he really wants the insurance money for the death of Henry Rowan for $25,000. He's like making a public stink about it. And it's like, this guy's an absolute moron. Like,
right.
He's just an idiot. He's so dumb. Why would you be making a public fuss about the $25,000 insurance money that you can't get for this guy who was murdered? Like, showing no remorse, obviously. But it's like, oh, I just really want this insurance money for this guy that happened to be murdered.
Right. I took out the policy. He died. What's the problem? Give me the money.
Right. Also, the fact that all of these murders are in this very specific order to funnel more and more inheritance money towards Burkhart and Hale is also a dead giveaway that they're the suspects. Like, they don't try to cover their tracks at all. And they're still doing this stuff while the BOI is in town investigating.
But it's also because they doesn't have the reputation that the FBI does today, so they're probably not, they're too dumb to be worried about it.
True, true. Yes, all of that put together. So they end up, they both end up getting arrested. Burkhart gets arrested on January 4th, 1926, and he ends up turning state's evidence and did so after the feds confronted him with Blackie Thompson, who's the guy that we see, not the jewelry robbery, but the bank robbery, the one that Hale puts him up to. So Blackie Thompson, I think he killed a police officer like when they showed up to arrest him.
Mm.
So he was already looking at life in prison. And basically the feds use him to get Ernest Burkhart to turn state's evidence against Hale, which he does. But regardless, Ernest is sentenced to life in prison at the Oklahoma State Penitentiary in McAlester, Oklahoma, in June of 1926. He's then released on parole in 1937 after spending 11 years in prison. And then 3 years later, in 1940, he robs his ex-sister-in-law's house and steals $7,000 with a different woman. He and that woman are both basically immediately arrested and convicted. His parole is revoked, obviously, because you can't be robbing people's houses when you're on parole. And is sentenced to 7 more years in prison, but then is paroled again in 1959, and after he's paroled, ends up getting pardoned by Oklahoma Governor Henry Bellman in 1965.
On what grounds?
I don't know. It didn't say.
It's like, it almost feels like, well, your only victims were natives, so I don't care. You're pardoned. Like, that's almost the vibe.
I don't know. I don't know. They mention it in the movie, and it mentions it in his Wikipedia page. I even went to the page for Henry Bellman, for the governor, and it doesn't say why. It just says that he, like, one of the things that he did while he was governor was pardon Ernest Burkhart.
But no corruption charges or anything associated with that governor? Like, nothing?
No, and actually, he was only governor for a couple years, so from 1962 to 19... Oh, he was, okay, so he was governor twice. He was governor from 63 to 67. Then he served on Nixon's election campaign.
Ah, ding, 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 ding.
And then he was a senator from 69 to 81, and then he was the governor again from 87 to 91.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, not only was there no, like, you know, him getting in trouble for corruption, he was a career politician. And, you know, was a senator and was the governor again. So I have no idea why he pardoned Ernest Burkhardt.
Interesting.
But anyway, yeah, that happened in 1965. And then he just kind of, Burkhardt kind of lives out the rest of his days in poverty and obscurity in Cleveland, Oklahoma, which is another small town in that area. And then dies on December 1st, 1986 at the age of 94.
Wow. Actually, and I'll step in here real quick so on the, the Molly side of things, because it is tied in. Cause, like, this was her husband who she had kids with and everything. And I kind of read that they had interviewed one of Molly's and Ernest's grandkids who then are on the other side of this, where it's just like, oh, we're aware that, like, grandpa's in jail and stuff like this, or the, or even when grandpa's out, we, like, know about him. And actually, let me see if I can find the line here real quick. Yeah, so this is, it says Margie's. This is one of the grandkids. Met her, this is from an article on insider.com. It says, Maggie met her grandfather as a teenager before his death in 1986, describing him as someone who, quote, looked like a sweet little man, unquote, but aware of what he did to her family. I have a lot of anger toward him, Margie told People Magazine, I'm guessing. He took away my whole family. He took away potential cousins. And yeah, Molly had remarried and died well before. You said Ernest lived till 1986. I mean, Molly died in 1937, almost 50 years before Ernest did, which is crazy.
Well, yeah, I'm sure that being poisoned for multiple years on end probably didn't do a lot for her health and longevity.
Yeah. Well, I just thought it was interesting getting, like, a granddaughter's perspective on Ernest as, like, oh, yeah, like, he's still my grandpa, but also, like, he, like, ruined our family, and we kind of just, he was around, but we kind of ignored him, and yeah, I don't just, it's an interesting vibe, I guess.
Yeah. His Wikipedia page said that after he died, I guess his will said that he wanted to be cremated and have his ashes scattered, like, in, you know, among the Osage Nation or whatever, and his son just took his ashes and threw him off a bridge.
There you go. Oh, probably the cowboy we see in the film. So the son's nickname was Cowboy. He's, like, probably the same.
Yeah, I mean, that would be his son. I forget the kid's actual name, but yeah, James. Yeah.
Okay.
James Burkhardt.
Sorry. Anyway, yeah. Then back to Hale.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So then after Hale's arrest, it gets kind of complicated. So I won't go into, like, the details, but he ends up being tried and appealing, like, several times, like, four different times. But he does end up getting convicted of murder in federal court on October 29th, 1929, and sentenced to life in Leavenworth Prison. He is actually, so he was tried with a guy named Ramsey for the Henry Rowan murder, and the Supreme Court actually had to make a decision in the case U.S. v. Ramsey to establish jurisdiction for the federal government on Indian territory. So if a native commits a crime against a non-native or vice versa, the U.S. government claims jurisdiction over that. And the Supreme Court decision that established that is U.S. v. Ramsey, which Hale was involved in. So, yeah, he's sentenced to life in 1929. He gets parole in July of 1947 after almost 18 years in prison, and then ends up moving to Phoenix, where he dies in a nursing home in 1962 at the age of 87, and he is buried, and I almost texted you this when I read it, but I wanted to get your reaction live. He's buried at the Mission Chapel Mausoleum at 21st and Hillside in Wichita.
Wait, what?
Right across the street from Wichita State.
Why? How? Huh?
I don't know. That's where he's buried. That's his, like, his final resting place.
Wait. So, like, a cemetery I've seen and ran by millions of times?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, that is bizarre.
Right? Because he's not from there. I don't even think he ever lived there. Yeah, there must be some, like, William Hale family connection to somebody in Wichita. But yeah, after he died in Phoenix, they transported his remains to Wichita, and he's buried in Wichita, Kansas.
Okay, that's kind of crazy. Like, yeah, yeah. Yeah, for the listener not familiar, yeah, I went to Wichita State University, which is at 21st and Hillside across the street from this cemetery. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, well, I mean, you've probably been there, you know, way more than me, but even I've been past that cemetery, like, a bunch of times.
Right, right. Oh, I was there, I drove by there last week. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, okay, yeah, crazy.
But yeah, that's the end of what I had on Hale, so.
The only other thing I was going to mention on the regular episode here was the 1920 election, because we see Lily go to Washington, D.C., and she actually gets a FaceTime briefly with President Coolidge to request help, and he seems to kind of dismiss her, but then the FBI is ultimately set in. And so, yeah, what the film does, the film skips over. He says it starts in 1919, and then we see President Coolidge, but that skips over President Harding. So we've been trying to, throughout this whole project, kind of at least mention every president as we go. So we've talked about Wilson. He was, you know, president from 1912 to 1920, or the, you know, 20 or 13 to 21 or whatever. In 1920 is when Harding gets elected. And so the most interesting thing about the 1920 election is that both vice president candidates later become president. Coolidge is obviously Harding's VP and takes over when Harding dies in office, but Harding was running against James Cox, whose VP candidate was FDR in 1920. Okay. So, you know, what is that? When does he get elected? 38? So 18 years before he gets elected president, or wait, no, sorry, 38 wouldn't be an election year. Was FDR elected in 36 or 40?
32.
Oh, 32?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Oh, it's only 12 years before he gets elected president. I forget he ran so many times. Duh. Okay.
Yeah.
Last time he was elected in 44, so he was elected 32, 36, 40, and 44. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I thought it was weird that the way Wikipedia worded this. So it says that the 1920 election was one of, quote, only six elections where both candidates had the same home state. And I'm like, only? Isn't six a lot? There's only been like 59 presidential elections. And the fact that six of them had the candidates from the same state, to me, seems high. I thought it was funny that Wikipedia said only six elections where both... Anyway, so both Harding and James Cox were from Ohio in this case. Hmm. Yeah, by my count, like that's over 10% of elections. That's really high. So Wilson, heading into 1920, actually was considering running for a third term, but he wasn't in good health, kind of either physically or mentally, and wasn't really popular following World War One and all those things, so he ended up not running. Teddy Roosevelt actually thought about running again too, but he died in 1919. So it was kind of wide open on both sides. It was kind of a big reset. We mentioned like all the, you know, how Teddy runs again against Taft, who he doesn't like, and that's what opens the door for Wilson to win. Like, and there's all this kind of, it's almost like messy. So like 1920 right. was like a full reset. There's no Republican coming in with baggage. There's no Democrat coming in with baggage. It's a kind of a reset election. And we're going to get new candidates this time around.
Wouldn't that be nice, Rich?
Wouldn't that be nice? Hashtag 2028.
Imagine.
I think 2028, we might have hope there. But who knows? Okay. And it was just kind of this big time for change in the country. There was actually, we were in a recession heading into this election following, there was a post-World War I economic boom, but that had kind of then dipped, and so we were in a little bit of a recession. Women could now vote, workers were striking for rights, the first Red Scares are popping up, which we've, I'm sure, no doubt talked about with Reds, following the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia, 1917. You mentioned anarchists. I thought this was interesting. I guess I never really give them, quote, anarchists much thought, but they were kind of a big deal in this time period. Like, heading into, I forget if it was 1919, 1920, but, like, there was, like, a 2 to 3 month period where around 36 officials and businessmen were targeted by anarchists with, like, bombs and stuff, mostly through the mail. And I think a couple, I didn't write down the deaths. I think a couple, most of them were unsuccessful, but like a couple people did end up dying. And there was this, I guess I didn't pull it up here, but there was like this Italian immigrant named Luigi Galliani. And like big anarchist. And so, like, they even talked about a lot of these assassination attempts were done under the name of, like, they were like, the group was like named after Galliani. They're like Gallianiites or whatever. And
okay.
So, but the idea is, I was just like, oh, anarchists, they just like blowing shit up. Like, I kind of have dismissed it. But I think specifically, there was an agenda, and the agenda was any broad-scale institution is inherently rife for corruption, therefore we must eliminate them. So they're anarchists in the sense that, okay, it's not, you guys want this government, we want this government. It's like, no, we want no government because all governments will be corrupt. So therefore, just blow it all up and let everything be handled at the local level was kind of the way I saw it. So they actually did have an agenda whereby they saw themselves as trying to make things better as opposed to just wanting chaos like the Joker in The Dark Knight, which is what I always usually think of with like anarchists. Does that kind of make sense? That there was a way that they actually kind of saw themselves as quote helping, but obviously they're just terrorists, right? And yeah, which again we'll get to, I'm sure we'll talk about similar things in Reds there. So anyway, yeah, with all this chaos in 1919 and 1920, Harding, senator from Ohio, is basically running on a quote return to normalcy that he was running. It's kind of funny, he basically ignored James Cox and was running against the legacy of Wilson. Like, he basically just ignored his actual opponent and just said, like, I'm going to take things back to normal. Let's just calm down. Again, it's a kind of a reset election. We're going to reset the whole country here. And it worked. So Harding actually won in a landslide. And he was actually the first Republican to carry a Southern state post-Reconstruction. He won the state of Tennessee and won the Electoral College 404 to 112.
Jeez.
Harding won the popular vote by 26 points. Like,
wow. So a blowout. Complete blowout.
Absolute blowout. The country was ready to move on. Now, despite that, Harding's legacy, and again, I'm kind of mentioning Harding here. He's not in the film, but like the film glosses over. He's only president for like 2 years because he dies in office here.
Yeah.
But his legacy is actually mostly one of corruption. Harding just appointed a bunch of his buddies to high positions in the government. And some of them did fine, but others either got away with A, doing absolutely nothing and just collecting a paycheck, or B, exploiting their positions for their own advantage. And this is where you get a scandal I had heard of, but had no idea what it was, the Teapot Dome scandal.
Oh, I've heard that phrase.
Right.
I have no idea what it means.
Right. I'm guessing it's something they mentioned in high school history class and we all just kind of glaze over. And that's probably fine. But yeah, so like, the simple version, Harding's tenure was full of corruption. The most notable one that everyone kind of just points to is the Teapot Dome scandal that, again, seems pretty simple on the surface. Basically, the Secretary of the Interior was accepting bribes to give cheap oil leases to oil companies in Teapot Dome, Wyoming. So I think the idea is like, instead of like taking bids and all these companies can basically, you know, highest bidder gets to do the oil, he basically said, oh, hey, you're going to bribe me and then I'll let you have the lease for next to nothing, basically giving you free oil for paying me off. So like it comes to light, and the Secretary of Interior actually went to prison over this. Although, of course, none of the oil executives who paid him off ever went to prison. But so actually, pre-Watergate, this was considered the biggest scandal in U.S. political history at the time. So like, it was
okay.
Big, big, massive scandal. Yeah, and again,
at time of recording.
The problem is that today, everything just gets shouted down. I mean, I'll go ahead and say it. Everything Trump's done is way worse than anything Nixon or Harding did, but everyone just sticks their fingers in their ears and goes, la, 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 la. It's not happening. It's not happening. Anyway, a lot can change by the time this episode airs. So then we get Harding dies in office, basically just a kind of a sudden illness. I think I heard on a video, cerebral hemorrhage, or just he just kind of fell suddenly ill and died pretty quickly in office of illness. I forget the exact thing. I don't have his page open. And Coolidge becomes president, and is actually instantly way more popular. None of the taint of the Harding corruption passes on to Coolidge. He was enough separated from it. He was called Silent Cal because he kind of wasn't easily ruffled, didn't say a lot. the one story, and again, I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but supposedly a woman comes up to Calvin Coolidge at a dinner party, and I don't know if this is before or after or during his presidency, but she's like, "Oh, I bet my friends that I could get you to say more than two words." And he just turns to her and says, "You lose."
That's funny.
So stuff like that. Very, very clever. What's funny, though, too, is with Coolidge. So, yeah, he takes over for Harding in 23, and then he gets elected again in 24. And actually, just because the 24 election, there's almost nothing worth talking about. It's basically because it's the Roaring Twenties. Calvin Coolidge is the president of the Roaring Twenties. So when 24 comes around, everyone's like, heck yeah, more of this, please. And just rubber stamps Coolidge, and he wins in a landslide also. The one noteworthy thing, though, in the 1924 election is that there was a significant third-party candidate who actually won the state of Wisconsin, running on the socialist ticket, which, again, I'm sure that'll maybe come up when we talk about, when we will have talked Reds. About Reds and stuff, too.
Hmm.
What's the other interesting thing, though, too, is that so Coolidge was in office until March of 29, just 7 months before the stock market crash. And Coolidge's whole thing was like deregulation. And so we always blame the Great Depression on Hoover, who had been in office for 7 months. And Coolidge was the, woo, let's party, there are no consequences, president. So it's like, and again, I'm sure we'll talk more about the Great Depression when it actually kind of comes up in the timeline, but I feel like Great Depression, Hoover's fault, FDR fixed it, is what everyone says. But I'm like, dude, is it actually probably Coolidge's fault as much as the president actually controls the economy at all, which is, you know, of course, subject to debate and probably overblown how much the president actually influences the economy one way or the other. But still, when Coolidge was a big deregulation guy and a laissez-faire capitalist guy and someone who Reagan was like, Coolidge is my guy, it is kind of interesting to see that he never really gets blamed for the stock market crash, at least in historical circles. Maybe economists do point to that. And it was just that Coolidge does seem to have been, when he was governor of Massachusetts, against prohibition, even though then he's then president during the Roaring Twenties when prohibition is in place, although it would have predated his presidency when it gets implemented, I guess. But, and we'll talk about that more down the line too. And he was a pro women's suffrage guy, so kind of just a let everybody do their own thing kind of guy is what Silent Cal seems to have been. Anyway, and then I don't know as far as his role with the FBI and sending them to Oklahoma for this investigation. Did you see anything about that specifically, or is it almost just like it? Yes, it happened during his presidency, but it wasn't like he was directly involved necessarily. Like, I don't know if Lily ever actually talked to him in person. I didn't see anything about that.
Yeah, I didn't see if Molly ever talked to him in person, and I don't know what the actual, you know, chain of command decision-making process was to get the FBI or the BOI agents to go. But yeah, like I said, and they even say in the movie that it wasn't like the president didn't send them, J. Edgar Hoover did. So...
Right. So, because who actually appointed Hoover though? Was it Harding or Coolidge? You said 24 was like he had just. You said Hoover had just taken over, right? So it would have been Coolidge, because Coolidge took office in August of 23.
So then it would have been Coolidge because Coolidge appointed him in 24. Yeah, because so 24 to 72, 48 years. Yes.
Oh, and the one cool thing about Coolidge was. So when he gets word that Harding has died, he's back home in Vermont. He was governor of Massachusetts, but he's kind of from Vermont. So anyway, he's back in Vermont. And when he gets the call, and his dad was a high enough up official in that area that Coolidge's dad swore him in as president at their home in like Vermont or whatever. So like his dad actually got to do the oath of office for his son to become president.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Which I thought was pretty cool. Man, so the one other thing I really wanted to mention, I think we're kind of running out of time here, that they do mention in the film is the Tulsa Race Massacre, and I think we're going to have to kick that to our side note. So for those of you who haven't, which I think is literally everybody has it right now, at time of recording, go over to patreon.com/historyandfilm. We do have a couple things up there for free just to kind of show you what it's all about, and then we do have other things. Early access to episodes and also just extras, kind of side conversations that Logan and I have off air or things that can't fit into the regular episodes here. We do have over there behind a paywall for a very small fee that will help us kind of pay for all our hosting fees. We are well over 6 years into the podcast and haven't asked for anything yet, so help us kind of keep the lights on, so to speak. If you have any other questions, comments, or concerns, don't hesitate to email me at simmons@tracknerds.com. And anything else before we kick into next week here, Logan?
Oh, yeah. While we're on the topic of Patreon, we're also going to be talking about the Tulsa Race Riots, and then also we're going to do our top 10 favorite Marty Scorsese movies. So that'll be over there too.
Yep, yep. So yeah, stay tuned for next time when our love of movies and our love of history will kind of overlap, because we will be dealing with Hollywood's transition from the silent era into talkies by looking at the films The Artist and Singing in the Rain.